Hi, and welcome to another episode of Talk Rehab. I'm Bill Nolting, and joining me today is Barry Dean, well-known gifted Nashville songwriter and co-founder of Lucy, a remarkable new company and product dedicated to keeping wheelchair users safe, comfortable, and connected. It started with a little girl in a power wheelchair, a mom who chose fight over flight, and two brothers who dared to take matters into their own hands. Hey, pretty good intro, which I shamelessly swiped right off their website. Lucy is getting a lot of attention. I'm certain that most of you are at least a little familiar with Lucy these days, and I'm thrilled that Barry took the time to not only meet with me today, but he brought a Lucy-equipped chair and gave me a demo. Very cool, very impressive. So let's get started. Barry, thanks for coming today, and thanks for the demo. Please tell us a little about yourself and where the Lucy inspiration came from.
Okay. I'm a songwriter, but I didn't start until I was in my 30s. I'd written and done music in bands and things when I was a teenager until I was about 19, and then I stopped and went into business and was working at an educational curriculum company.
Where were you a teenager?
In Pittsburgh, Kansas. I was raised in a little town in Kansas near Joplin, Missouri, Route 66. Born in Oklahoma, but then raised there. And there was an education company in our family. My father and mother started it. It served industrial arts teachers, which some people wouldn't even know what that is. They became technology educators, that field, and then it kind of moved into applied physics and hands-on manipulatives. And now I think you'd call it STEM. And that's what their little company did. And so I worked there at the company and helped, I think, with my team grow it from industrial arts to these other areas with a team of people. I can't take credit for all that, but we had a great team, and I built it into a sizable company. And and then for many years, it was the distributor of all Lego education products in America. That was another thing.
Really?
So, yeah, so that was kind of where I came from. But I got married, and I was trying to decide whether I wanted to stay in this little town. And we had this young lady, Catherine. We were going to St. Louis Children's for medical care a lot. That's 4 or 5 hours away. So we decided, my wife, which is how I should say that, decided we should talk about where we should live, and being near a children's hospital was a good idea. She asked me what I had wanted to do, and I told her I'd always dreamed of being a songwriter, but then put that away. And so on our second anniversary, I think it was, she would know, she came in and said, "Will you take me on a cruise for our anniversary?" I said, "Yes," which is the secret to my part of the relationship. And she said, "This is the one." And it was the Nashville Songwriters Association had a cruise. They only did it twice. And this was the second one. I went on the cruise, and there was Hugh Prestwood and Craig Wiseman, and some of the great songwriters were there, Steve Seskin and Angela Cassatt. And you would go hear them talk about songwriting in the morning. And then in the evening, they'd do shows. But the rest of the day, you were, you know, sunburning yourself or wrecking the scooter or whatever you're supposed to do on a cruise. And so we did that. And the last day of the cruise, I was sitting in the back quietly taking notes. Everybody else was a really good guitar player or a really good songwriter. They were more pushing their songs, I think, more. And the last day, two of the writers came over
Sure.
and said, "Well, you're the only one on the boat who hasn't tried to play us a song, so why don't you play a song?" And so I played one, because they were saying, "You're either really bad or really good. We just can't tell." And I said, "I think I'm kind of in the middle, frankly. I mean, with what I've been hearing." And so I played it, and they said, "Don't quit your day job, but next month we're doing a thing. Why don't you come to Nashville?" And so I started making these trips, and we decided, I'm gonna try to become a songwriter. And so I realized that's how I'd always been wired inside, was that's how I process the world, is writing songs. Still how I process it. So I came to Nashville as a songwriter.
What year was that?
That would have been 15 years ago. So, you know, right in there. And 2005, I think, you know, I waited, you know, I got a deal with BMG Publishing, which was after a couple of years of going back and forth. And I was a keyboard player. I'm a keyboard player. So I started taking these marathon guitar lessons. I'd come in and take a 3 or 4 hour guitar lesson, and I would video it or audio record it. Then I'd go back to Kansas and Woodshed. No one would write with me because I was an older guy from out of town. So back then, being from out of town was a real problem. Now it's, I think, very different. But so I just wrote a lot by myself. And after a couple of years, I had a song get the interest of BMG, and I was signed by BMG. And then Reba and Martina cut songs back to back. And Reba's wasn't a single, but it was a really big deal. It opened the door for the writing of the Martina song. And then the Martina song was my first song in the top 20. So
nice.
So that was, and then after that, that was really when the decision was, are we going to keep doing this? Or are we going to, you know, where I'm 60 days a year in Nashville and then home, or are we going to come to Nashville? And so I jokingly say, but it's pretty true, I thought I'd seen how talented everyone was and how incredible everyone was. And I was like, you know, I think we're set up pretty good here in Pittsburgh, Kansas, and I can build whatever we need. And, you know, cost of living's reasonable and all that. And Jen was, you know, that was my position. Jen's position was, we need to be near a children's hospital. There's more opportunities. And, you know, you want to do this. Let's go. And so we compromised and did what she said.
So your wife talked you into it.
She talked me into it. That's which I know great. Is very different than the normal story. Yeah.
So you were entrepreneur kind of guy mm-hmm. in this business. And then yeah. you said you dreamed of being a songwriter, mm-hmm. which means you're writing songs the whole time.
That's right.
When did wheelchairs become a part of your life?
Well, you know, Catherine, when we got here, Catherine was 4 or 5. And so we went to get, we'd been using just strollers. And so we had this great new clinic situation we were at here. And so they were like, you know, you really should move her to a wheelchair. As I recall, it was a Quickie 2 maybe. And so I said, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And they were like, but we should file for the power chair first. So we got a power chair first and then the Quickie.
And this is 15 years ago.
15 years ago, yeah. Okay. And it really was, I think, a typical, I don't say this proudly, but I think I was a typical story that I have now heard 15 years later from clinicians. I'm a dad that's reticent. I'm really interested in walkers. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to push that. I don't want to surrender anything. I'm trying to use words that I might have thought at that time. Power chair seemed a little too big, too scary. And I didn't want it to seem like I was surrendering, you know, or giving up on this girl who'd fought so hard. And
right.
So all sort of the stereotypical things I now hear, and they'll say, they don't realize I'm that guy, because they'll say, well, you know how those dads are, where they come in and you're like, oh my gosh, that's me, actually. So I understand. So anyway, we got the first chair, and after a few years, it was working. You know, we were reticent about the power chair, and our house wasn't really well set up for it, real suited for it. So it was really parked for a long time. Then it went to the school, and she would use it all day at school and then come home and be in her manual. Then really, as she learned to drive it, and I went and saw her drive it at school, we were like, we got to deal with this. So then we did this whole adaptive thing, you know, for the house so she could get around. And I'm so glad we did. I wish we'd have done it sooner. I know she does.
Apparently she had enough upper body strength to use the manual chair, or did you use it more like a stroller?
More like a stroller. She mm-hmm. she has, her right arm is very strong. She can throw better than I can, but her left arm is heavily constricted and in fact has been fused at the wrist and they was very constricted. And yeah, her right hand and arm are really strong. But we looked into like the ones where you push
single
one.
Single wheel drive.
Yeah.
Yep.
But they're pretty heavy and she likes to go, you know. And again, me being, I'm sorry to admit this, but I was very reticent to do the ramp van. I was just like, you know.
Felt like it's giving up.
It did. I think there was, Jennifer, you know, when Catherine was born, Jennifer said, they showed her the baby, you know, when we thought we were losing Catherine, but they showed her the baby and Jennifer just said, fight. And so I didn't want to do anything that wasn't, you know, I don't know how many walkers we bought. And I'm thinking right now of Carol Schrader and her speech at Pittsburgh at ISS last time. Mm-hmm. Jennifer and I sat in that audience with tears in our eyes because we knew exactly what she was talking about. Because she was saying, I fought so hard to get one of her children, I can't really speak for her, but I can say for Catherine, fought so hard to help her walk. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I do look back on certain areas and think, I should have accepted where we were at and allowed her to have seated mobility and have her strength and not be worn out, you know, from trying to walk into the school. Now I get in school, I'm too tired to visit. I mean, she loves to go to school. She loves to meet people, but she was just worn out. And again, you do what you do and you just try to do better the next day. But that talk that Carol gave was, she had our number, you know, and I thought it was wonderful that the ISS group had them speak, her speak, because I just thought it was a beautiful thing to say, hey, I suddenly have embraced. And I say that with, you know, we have through different friends, we'll meet some parents who have a little one who's starting down this road, you know, a preemie or someone with cerebral palsy. And they'll say, will you talk to this husband and wife? And I try to talk to the dads about, like, why it matters that you stand, you know, and it's not why you think. You thought it was so she or he could stand and walk. But maybe it's about bone density and hip development and those kinds of things that I don't know that I was smart enough to learn going forward in real motion, you know, through the woods. And so you kind of try to go, okay, well, you don't have to be freaked out about that. You don't have to feel this way about that. You can embrace it. I wish I'd have done more of that, but we're trying to fix that now.
And do you have a soapbox about that? Are you a soapbox preacher when it comes to that topic?
I guess I didn't mean to be there, but I guess, I mean, I just feel like there's no reason someone has to make the mistakes I've made or not be aware of some of the things I probably should have done the research and been aware of. And I think of Jenny Palig and her work to sort of diagnose cerebral palsy earlier and use that scale. Mm-hmm. I'm not a clinician, so I don't remember all the technical terms for it, but I remember seeing that and thinking, oh, I remember them saying, we'll wait till she's three to do that diagnosis. And so it held a lot of things that really could have helped, you know. And that's just how it was done, you know, in our county at that time.
Right.
But, and we had great folks in the county. I'm not bagging on them. It's just things evolve. And as I've learned and met other folks, I'm so happy to share it. And if that means I have to go, hey, I didn't really do it right, but you could do it right. Or, hey, I didn't know this, but you could know this. I'm kind of that guy, you know. So
during that period, you experienced some bumps and collisions and saw a friend have a collision. And
yes.
That got you thinking about Lucy?
It did. You know, really, this is an incredibly narcissistic sounding story. But when I had my first number one, which was after all this years of work, and of course, you never realize how long it'll take. And or maybe I just made it look harder than everybody else, but it took a long time. And so the morning it went number one, Jennifer came in and said, you know, congratulations. And she was like, so what are you going to do? You're going to buy a truck? You're going to get a guitar? You're going to get... No, most songwriters do pretty
something.
Stereotypical things. Get a new pair of boots. You know, there's something. New haircut, whatever. And so I said, well, I've been thinking about the house, how to make it accessible for the wheelchair. Really accessible. I've also been noticing, just to be completely honest, that Catherine at that time drooled a lot when she slept. And I said, I feel like I can't find a pillowcase that wicks the moisture away from her skin. And also, I get nervous a little bit when she's driving around the yard. Maybe we ought to put a beeper on it or something. And so I called my brother. This is before we did Lucy, 2 years before. And I just called and said, hey, can you come out this weekend? And he's really kind and did. And so I said, there's these three things I want to do. And he goes, you want to do those this weekend? It's like Friday afternoon. You want to do these three things by Sunday? Okay. Well, I see you really get it. And so we worked on, and he really did the smart parts of the pillowcase.
Mm-hmm.
And so that worked out good. And then we made sketches on the house. And then we began down that road. And so it took, you know, the better part of a year to year and a half to decide, you know, are we going to remodel our house? How would that be? Are we going to build a house? Are you going to buy an existing house? And so we did find a house and did the remodeling and approached it that way. And he and Jennifer, my wife, did all the hard work with, you know, Stephanie Gilboy is a designer they worked with. And they built this lovely suite. It's fully connected to our house. And I think there's only one room in our home she can't go in. And so we made that the boys' room. For our brothers. We thought that seemed right. And
so
they're protected from, you know, intrusion. But everything else was taken care of. And that's really when, right around that time is when Troy's mom took the spill. And that sort of rekindled that third thought. And by that time, we'd made a little beeper, ultrasonic sensor with the beeper. It was a horrible failure. You know, it wasn't just that it didn't really do what it needed to do or really change anything because of her reaction time. Obviously, the beep could happen, but her reaction time is very slow. Mm-hmm. But also, she figured out that if she triggered the beep, everybody came running. And she is a social creature, if nothing else. So she had a She would love it. She'd beep. We'd come around the corner huffing, you know, and she'd be laughing. She knew we were coming. And so we were like, this is not at all doing what we were trying to do. She's literally driving at things to make it beep to get, you know, to see, just to watch the show. So we were like, okay, we got to do something else. And anyway, we flash forward, and that's when Troy's mom, Gay, got heard. And we were like, okay, this is something. And again, we thought we would find it and in the market, and we didn't.
So now Lucy is more than just a gleam in your eye. How did you actually decide to start the company?
Okay. It's a very short history, really. It's the last 3 years, really. You know, I'm a songwriter, and a friend of mine's a songwriter, and his mother had the same model chair as my daughter. She had taken a ramp just a little high, turned a little too soon, and it flipped that chair, and she was injured badly, but she's fine now. And so I hadn't really thought of that too much. You know, I mean, you're aware of some of it, but I didn't think of that happening commonly. And so I came home and I was looking around at the house, and, you know, Catherine loves to drive out there on the sidewalks and all the different things. And anyway, I'm out there and I'm looking around. I call my brother. He's younger and smarter. And so I call him and I say, listen, I know you like to do math with letters and all. What am I looking for? You know, what's going to flip this thing? What are my problems? And so he gets back to me with, you know, this around 2 3/4 inches, I think it was, for that model, if you're going forward and if you're going this direction. So I said, you know what I think I'm going to do? There's probably somebody who's figured this out. A little safety thing, a warning system, maybe a different chair. We'll get a different chair. And so I started Googling things, and he started looking up things. We couldn't find it. And so we went to the International Seating Symposium. It was the last year it was here in Nashville, so maybe 4 years ago. We went and toured that. I saw it was going to be here. In the meantime, leading up to that, at Christmas, we were talking, and we were talking about sensor fusion. We were talking about how you might do a thing. And he said, I think I got an idea. And I said, well, why don't you make a little alpha out of it, bring it out, and we'll try it. And if not, we'll go over to the convention, and probably somebody's already done it. So he showed up, and I think that was the 1st of March of that year, and he'd done it. It didn't drive. It was very primitive. He used Tetrix, some Tetrix parts, in kind of an inner family joke about our educational background, mm-hmm. and some rapid prototype things, off-the-shelf sensors, that kind of a thing, ultrasonics. It didn't run into walls. It didn't drive off curbs, and it was pretty surprising.
Who were you showing this to? Whoever would watch?
No, we didn't show it to anybody. I went to my co-write that day with an artist called Cam, and I told my wife, hey, if it doesn't work, tell Jared not to feel bad. He's my brother, right? So I'm like, right, thinking, oh, this may not work, and then we'll have dinner, that kind of thing. And she texts me a video around 3 o'clock. There it was. I mean, he had done it. So I was like, okay, I'll meet you out at Opryland, and we'll go to the show. We talked to a couple of people, and they were nice, but they were like, that'd be really hard to do, mm-hmm. or boy, that one guy said that'd be really helpful because we've had some trouble with assistive living centers and schools. And we were like, but are you working on it? Because we really were not trying to start a company or find a way in. We literally were just looking for a solution. So we decided we would do a beta, just what would we change about that? And so we added LiDAR, as I told you, and some more processing, and that was built in the next 60 days.
And you knew the solution you were looking for.
Yeah, at that point we were. And I would say yes, but I would also say it was a smaller vision. We were very focused on collision avoidance, drop-off protection, and tip alerting. That's mm-hmm. what we were worried about. We weren't thinking in terms of longer term or companies. We were just thinking, can it be solved? So as we were playing with that through the music business, I met a friend who said, hey, you know, I don't know anything about this, but my uncle is a guru in the GPS agriculture world. So we end up meeting with him, and he's like, this is great. Here's what you need to do, and you need to talk to these guys in Seattle and Bainbridge, Washington. They own, at one point, the second most patents in autonomous vehicles, second only to Google.
Wow.
And I think they've sold them since, but a lot of them. Really incredible team. They worked on OnStar. They worked on Sync for Ford. And so then they were like, come on out and let's talk. And so when we met with them, they really challenged us. And I told you this on the phone. I said when we met them, this is my brother. He's 64 crayons with a sharpener, and I'm the three you get at an Applebee's, you know. But the cheetah out there said, yeah, but you can tell us stories. So we want you to write all the things you'd like this wheelchair to do in the next 15 years as really involved stories.
In the next 15 years?
That's what I did. I'd write songs 3 or 4 days, then I'd get on a plane, fly to Seattle and work with them for 3 or 4 days, and I'd fly back and write. And we did that for months and months. And meanwhile, we're building an IP portfolio and building a set of stories. In the end, we narrowed the stories down to about 42 stories. Chose 42 because of Jackie Robinson. That was it. We were like 42, 43. I have Jackie Robinson, 42. And so it really was not being done in a, it's not a good investment banker story. But the nice thing about having those stories and the look at different people, you know, friends of ours, Tom Dayton, a friend of mine I've known him since fifth grade, been in a chair and calling him and going, what are you looking for? What things frustrate you? Or what do you wish? Have you ever yelled at your chair? You know, and so I'm just writing stories. And some of the stories, I'm not going to lie, some of them are probably frivolous to somebody. You know, I went to a wedding of a friend. His mother was in a stand-up kind of chair.
Mm-hmm.
So when it came time to dance, she still is a vivacious, incredible woman. She's in charge of any room she's in. But she was a big dancer, and now she can't. And so she stands up, and her son holds her for the wedding thing, dance, and she cried. And so then I'm thinking, oh, wait. So I go take some dance lessons, find I'm a horrible dancer. My wife's a very good dancer. But could we, if we were able to be within 3 centimeters of proximity, if we were able to do things, could there be the potential for this? And that's really all we were trying to do, is make sure we didn't shortchange the potential for what we could do. So then after that was all, the 42 stories were written, we sat down, and really there were 3 things we would have to do to provide the potential for those stories and other stories. And those were to make the chair itself situationally aware, you know, environmental surveillance, some people would call it, and to put a brain on it, to make it smarter. I mean, even the alt drive innovations are still having to sort of throttle down through that control system. And so we thought, okay, we make it smarter. And then the third was if you could connect it securely. So we decided that's what we would solve. And again, at that time, we were still, this would maybe be 2 years ago, we were thinking, well, we have an IP portfolio. We have, at this point, a much more aggressive prototype. And that prototype ran for a year and a couple of months before my daughter got a new chair. And so we switched prototype chairs out in Colorado to match her chair. And that's when we started adding other models and things. But in there, we sort of realized it was going to be really hard to get a company in the industry to do it.
What do you mean a company to do it?
To take the engineering and make it for the market. I mean, there's not a code for it. I mean, it's kind of the catch-22, isn't it? There's not a code, so we won't do it. And so we won't do it because there's not a code. And so it's pretty nice get out. So it's kind of been that way. And I understand the need for all of it, but I'm looking at it and I'm reading the research papers that are saying, well, we're going to try to experiment with this kind of sensor or that kind of sensor. And in the next 10 years, it might. So Catherine's going to be 40 when we finally connect this to Alexa. And I'm not a fan of Alexa and Hey Google. I mean, those kinds of things. I always said we wouldn't have it at the house. And then my daughter, my one and only daughter, she discovers it at a friend's house, and she wants to do it with her lights. She loved it, and so now suddenly I do have one of those things.
Well, the automation benefit outweighs the snoop potential.
Yeah, so all of a sudden I'm like, okay, you can listen to everything because it makes her super happy and she can control her world. But those kinds of moments sort of led, I think impatience maybe is what that's labeled as, led us to going, you know, we've been really, frankly, blessed with people intervening and teaching us, like you're doing too, and your podcast has done, so that we could go, okay, I see how that works now, and I understand there's a very difficult situation there, maybe even a problem that seems chicken and egg difficult to solve. And some of those we can, and some of those we can't, but at this point we decided, well, we're going to make it. And I also don't, just as a parent living through this, anytime somebody posts on social media some well-intentioned and even brilliant designer from some design college does a 3D animation of a wheelchair that, you know, whatever, floats. But it's an animation, you know, and it hits the social media, and then I'm going to get it from everyone I've ever met. Oh, you should look at this. And you think, oh, that looks exciting. And you're like, yeah, that's just an animation. And it's not even speculated that they'll try to make that. And I didn't want to be a part of that. I wanted us, if we were going to talk about it, I wanted to be able to physically put it on something and let you see, does this help me? Does it not? Is this what I thought it was? And so we decided, okay, well, we're going to have to kind of risk some things and step up.
Did you end up partnering with the Cheetahs and the 42 Stories?
Yeah. We hired them, and then over time, you know, now we have a little closer working relationship, but we're still self-funded. That may change in the coming year. We'd like to find good partners for that. We met early on through the Cheetahs with an investment potential and wonderful guy. And again, kind of like my well-intentioned friend saying, focus on your music career. Mm-hmm. He basically said, this is super cool. The IP is amazing. The tech is looking great. You know what you should do? You should let me invest, and we should take it to golf carts and Caterpillar and lawnmowers and things you use in factories, mm-hmm. and all that. And then if you guys want to do wheelchairs, then you can mess with wheelchairs. So when they left, one of the Cheetahs said, what do you think? And I just said, I think he's great. And down the road, I'd love to work with him, but we flew out here to do wheelchairs. That's what we came out to do. So we're going to do it, crazy as that is.
And where are the 42 stories?
Well, we haven't published them, but we have them. And I have thought about doing that because I'm really excited about the idea of having a standard API so mm-hmm. other people could do research and testing or develop things, and a software developer kit. And we don't have that ready yet, but we have, my brother will kill me for talking about it, but we have an alpha software developer kit that we're already working with, because I think the next 42 stories will be even more visionary, because that'll be more clinician stories and more researcher stories and more user stories that I don't know. It just helped us build a, you hear the word platform a lot in technology, and so I'm hesitating, but it is a platform. It would allow for development across the world. And we would like to try to position ourselves as Switzerland here. The easier play was to go to one company and let them buy it or take money or those kinds of things. But it felt like you are handing over the keys to a lot of things in development for this community. So it felt like it was incumbent upon us to try to stay neutral as long as we could. And even in choosing, originally we were going to try to release one share from every brand. And then at a certain point, being self-funded, we were like, okay, we're going to need to, you
know, whittle it down.
Yeah, whittle it down a little bit, look at sales numbers and kind of go, okay, well, this at least sends the message that we really do want to work with people.
How are you protecting the concept?
Yeah, a lot of patents involved. I mean, I don't know if it's a lot, but we have 17 patents filed, 8 have issued already. And mm-hmm. then there's been a lot of protection of, you know, certain design elements and things. But I will say this, it's a really hard thing to do. That's why it probably hasn't been done. If someone wants to try to, it would just be a lot easier, I think, for them to work with us, because we really want to work with people.
Sure.
You know, I think that would be easier. Even when you figure out the sensors, research studies are a really good example. If it's a 3-year study, the first year they're trying to figure out, oh, what sensor do I use? And they'll spend the year trying to, how do I pay for these sensors? How do I get them here? How do
right.
I test them? So we did all that. That's how we got to be friends with Intel and TI. And then the second year is, how do I get that sensor data filtered, processed? What are the algorithms? And I need to communicate it somewhere. And that creates its own sort of problem. And then by the third year of your study, if you were successful, you're scrambling to get the data you really were sitting out to do. I just wanted to know time and seat. I just wanted to know if a heart rate affected drive ability, you know, those kinds of things. Our hope is we can shorten that gap so you don't have to answer those first 2 years' questions.
So that all sort of came together in 2017.
I think that's right. That's when we decided we were going to start a company and we're going to do this.
And where are you now?
Well, we have a small company, you know, and Lucy is a corporation, and we have our engineering and R&D in Colorado, and then we have our headquarters here in Nashville. We're a very small company. Right now, I think it's 12 full-time folks, and it may be 6 or 8 part-time or contractor in the office.
Obviously, your brother is part of the Lucy team. Tell me about the Lucy team.
Okay. Well, Jared's the key part of it. If there's no Jared, you know, there's really not much of a story. He went to Colorado School of Mines, mechanical engineering, really into product design and systems engineering, got his master's. And he went to work. He worked with a company called Synchronous, which is a really big product development firm worldwide. And so he worked on everything from Atlas V rockets to machines that clean the blood for diabetes. I'm blanking on the name of it, but dialysis machines. Yeah, very cutting edge stuff for that. He was team lead on the first wireless charger for Tesla, you know, stuff. And so he's an accomplished engineer in that area. And so our story would be very different were he not. But he had dealt with the FDA and all those things. So then he had taken a job, and I think he had been there 5 years, but it may have been more than that, at the Colorado School of Mines. He was a professor there, and he was the head of their senior capstone program, which was number one in the nation. And, you know, he was a great asset to Colorado School of Mines and loved working with the students. So that's what he was doing when we kicked off Lucy, you know, the idea of doing this. And we spent about a year before we locked in on the name Lucy and went after it. So he was doing engineering, and he's who worked most of the time with the team in Seattle on the patents and the technology. And so then the other folks on the team, Pete Knapp, you know, he came out of the hearing industry. He was a CEO there. He was a VP there. He spent, I think, over a decade. And I always joke, you know, his training, his background is accounting. He was an auditor of Motorola for I don't know how long. Then he went to the Tribune. It's been a decade in mergers and acquisitions for them, and then got out of that and went into hearing. So he has some real bona fides from the business side. And so I say, you know, he's got no excuse. He knows how crazy this journey is, and he still did it. So he's probably the only brave one. And then out in Colorado, we have a team of roboticists and engineers and programmers that are specifically development and user focused, you know. So we've had, you know, Kelly Wadd, Michelle Lang, Gene Minkle, and anyone we could get come in, and they'll do lectures, all afternoon lectures with slides, you know, teaching about this. And most of them came from the roboticist side or embedded system side. Outside our company, you have programmers at different companies that we've contracted with, so we can have sort of more firepower and move faster. I mean, a lot of this was about moving fast, and so we felt like we had to, and so that's how we did it. And I think we've got a few. We do have Sarah here in Nashville who is a media person, came out of TV production and, you know, worked on all the famous reality TV shows that I don't know very well, but she was in LA and then she was here. And if it's a show with some crazy celebrity, or if it's a show about I bought this house and I don't know if I want to flop it or not or whatever, she's produced on all those shows. And so we brought her in. Her mother had MS and also had a horrible accident, and her wheelchair broke both femurs.
Wow.
And didn't know that when I saw her. I knew her from my time in the music business, and we ran into her at an event and said, let's have dinner. So we caught dinner at Mockingbird. And, you know, this has been a very Nashville approach to this, in the sense of business manager says, call this person, you know, a music business person. Mm-hmm. And someone else says, oh, you should talk to that person. And then it's been the same way on the, there's some kind of a similarity over on the seating and mobility side. It seemed like I told you, Susan Johnson Taylor took us to Gene Minkle, who took us. And we're still doing that. I mean, we're still just continuing that door opens thing. One of our slogans was, internally, we had four, but one of them was that we were going to be fueled by collaboration because we're so small. So we're going to, again, try to be neutral, try to work with people whenever we can. We're going to go listen to clinicians and just try to be responsive to that. It's a little misleading because I know that at any given time we're working with, I don't know, 16 other firms and 50 other people that aren't employees. So right. It's a little bigger footprint than it sounds like. But that we're still really small. But we're excited. We're getting good feedback. We've just released publicly that we exist in the last 4 or 5 weeks.
Well, I see a new something on LinkedIn every morning.
They're doing a lot of that. Then in the fall is when we think we'll go for sale. But we're currently, we needed to start those meetings with the manufacturers mm-hmm. and with the providers. And so we thought this is time.
Well, here's a question a lot of people are asking. Is Lucy an acronym?
Well, we tried to make it one after the fact, and it was embarrassing. Lucy comes from the code name of our cloud development team. Was Lucy. I think Jared's wife said, oh, you should call the cloud development team Lucy because Catherine's favorite song is Lucy in the Sky.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're like, okay, that's funny. And we put that on there. As the world evolved, you know, as we were trying to figure out the name for what we're doing, Lucy showed up. And in fact, we hired a brand agency and they came in to help with naming, you know, and they do all these different things. You know, what plant are you? And it was funny because they said, in all the years we've done this, we've never said this, but can we ask why you're not using Lucy as your name? And that kind of fits with the tech world anyway,
yeah.
Know, the naming of things. So we were like, okay, let's do it. So then we were like, oh, we'll make an acronym. Then we were like, let's just admit it. It's just based on
it's just Lucy.
Song. It's Lucy.
It's all capital letters.
All capital letters. We were surprised. And then we have that logo, which is really cool, but a whole lot of colors, you know. And
yeah.
And you're like, oh. We're
not
never,
good for printing the brochure.
No, yeah, I knew your marketing background. You're like me. You're like, wait, I would never have that. And they're like, but we love it. And then there was a clinician who was like, this is great. We were really impacted. We watched this documentary that Colorado Public Television did on the Gang of 19 and that summer. And so that was a big influencer for us.
When I was looking around the website, I saw the MSRP was $84.45, I think. And I know that it's software heavy. Is there a subscription fee to keep the software updated?
We've chosen to make that all in. We didn't do a subscription fee on the software. We may in other products down the road mm-hmm. do that. But with this, because of the price point specifically, and also over-the-air updates don't just, it benefits everybody. We want everybody to have the best thing we can do. So we felt like that needs to be all included. And as far as who installs it, obviously that we're having meetings now to determine the providers that may or may not want to work with us and installing that. Obviously, there's going to be training. I think the installation process will be pretty seamless. Internally, we call it infallible installation. I mean, mm-hmm. Can I go in or can a tech go in 25 minutes and have it prepped? And the hardware is pretty easy. But we're still learning how to communicate some of the software things. As you know, the software always becomes the usability of that. Does mm-hmm. that work? Does that not work? Is there a better way to do that? I understand it's an expensive addition. You know, I mean, almost everything on my daughter's power wheelchair is an expensive addition. From the seat cushion to the we've done replacement joysticks and all that, new foot plates. But we felt like, you know, we're going to be able to ride the automotive cost curves as units increase and those cost curves continue to go in our favor. I think that it will be able to see that drop. But we needed to establish an MSRP. And I think there's margin there for the providers. And that we've had some good advice from people, clinicians, but also we asked Tom Borscherding, you know, kind of came in and did some advising on mm-hmm. setting up sort of the charts on that and others. But I'm open to any suggestions or thoughts on it. It's a whole new world, and not having come from being an ATP or being a physical therapist or clinician, it has all been new. So it's a very new thing, you know, and that's. But I read a little about you, of course, and I've asked some mutual friends, and it seemed like you were a role player. Like if you needed a CIO, there you were a CIO. Now marketing, I could do marketing. You were able to adapt and learn and succeed in different areas. And I've never had to do it at this level. But on the songwriting side, I am somewhat familiar with, like, I came to town, thought I was a music guy.
Right.
And then somewhere in there realized, I think my proper path is over here, kind of being a showrunner, being a melody and lyric person in the room. Mm-hmm. And so I need to learn these certain things. So I'm going to study the history of that and the vocabulary of that and some of the issues of that to get myself up to speed so I can begin learning. And so I've been trying to apply that over here. So
is it working?
Well, you'd probably be a better judge than me, honestly. But I think it has helped. I mean, collaboration is a really big deal on the music side, as you know. So we kind of made a decision that if we didn't do that, we would be foolish because we've learned so much. As an example, I think I told you Gene Minkel. We went to Canada 2 years ago or whenever that was, and we met Susan Johnson Taylor. She introduced us to Gene Minkel. Mm-hmm. And Gene promptly said, you can come to Brooklyn and basically sit for the class. And so we came, spent a whole day in her office. She's handing us books. She's showing us videos. And she has graciously been a part of our team, helping us and advising us. And she's introduced us to Kelly Waugh and to Michelle Lang and to and Claudia A. And, you know, so many people.
Everybody.
Yeah, it's really been wonderful. And there's others. I mean, that's about off the top of my head. And there's some folks, as we understood, there were these organizations and these conventions and these opportunities to learn. That helped in my own family. Jen and I suddenly are like, oh, let's go hear Jeannie Palick speak, or let's go hear this person speak. And I've gone, as I told you, and heard Mark Spaler speak several times about all manner of topics. I just heard Spriegel from Georgia Tech spoke on balancing manual wheelchairs, which, you know, I understand doesn't have anything to do with Lucy, but it's fascinating because I didn't know. I was a father of someone who was living with this, but I didn't understand that side because we've always pretty much been in the power world.
Have you been looking into HCPCS codes for Lucy?
Claudia has. I have not, but mm-hmm. Claudia has been looking. I think we're going to be KO-108 miscellaneous.
Sure.
And just go that way with it. And
well, that works.
So so that's the plan early on, because obviously not having a code makes it, I guess it makes it difficult, though Claudia has assured me she thinks it's probably better than if there was an outdated code that we were being kind of forced into, you know, something set 25 years ago before most of the technology was around.
She would know.
Yeah, that's I do kind of follow her lead on that. But early on, I think my wife saw that she was speaking at one of the ISSs, and that's how we met her. And we ended up meeting in an airport, but she's been a great advisor. And again, we've tried to seek that out. And going back to sales, I do think there'll be excitement from ATPs and clinicians because they're being asked, I think, to, and I'm not trying to say I know exactly, but it seems like I'm hearing stories where they're being asked to make really difficult judgments. Is the person safe in the chair? Yes, it feels like this, in pediatric chairs, it feels like this kid can drive and the kid does well, but what happens if he gets mad and he chases his sister? Suddenly it takes a weird turn because of the velocity and the weight. And so systems like ours could really help people be more successful, people be more comfortable, parents certainly. Peter, our COO, came from the hearing world, adaptive.
Mm-hmm.
He brought sort of the professional business, some exposure to the healthcare world. Jared coming from manufacturing and tech and product development. So he was really versed in FDA and FCC and that world, but not so much how you actually provide this in the health world. And they're not the same, hearing aids. I'm not trying to say that hearing is the same as this, but it has allowed him to move very quickly, working with Claudia and others and the clinicians to go, oh, I see. And it seems to make a lot more sense to him than to me as a dad, as a songwriter.
Have there been any letters of medical necessity written?
We haven't written any, but we have spoken with some folks, the clinicians that are on the website and some mm-hmm. others, saying we'd like to talk about how that should be handled. And certainly there's a few. We think the first filings, when we first go to get funding, we'll probably have Claudia A. and that team, you know, just be there to support and help in any way we can. We did make, with Claudia's help and some clinicians, we made a new little brochure. They call it a funding toolkit, but it's really just a brochure to kind of help step through how we think to position, you know, Lucy as you're doing that. So we'll try to be, that's going to be a huge climb for us.
That makes me think of standards. That was a pretty huge climb. I think you mentioned that your daughter has a stander.
She has an F3 now, but she did have the C400 standard. You know, that's an interesting story. I told our team when we started, we love our ATP that we've worked with for years. But the way that conversation goes, and I'm sort of embellishing it a little bit, but I was trying to explain to our team. So I say, yeah, we're looking at this chair. It's kind of like the last chair. Is there another brand? Well, yeah, there are. There are other brands, but this is probably... you're probably going to like this one. And so, you know, show you two brands or whatever. And you say, well, I heard there's going to be a chair that'll stand. Well, I've heard that, but I haven't seen it. Well, okay. Do you think it's coming out soon? Yeah, it is coming out soon. Well, how much is it going to be? Well, I'm not sure your insurance will cover it. Probably be private pay. And, you know, we call those Nashville no's in the mm-hmm. music business. It wasn't meant in any way negative. It's just outside the norm. I don't know if it was outside the formulary or just outside the norm, but I do think, you know, Lucy, we knew we had to communicate ourselves, because if the user is aware of something and goes in and asks, or if the clinician asks, they still have to go through that provider's recommendations, training, you know, that's going to be a big initiative for us this year, is communicating with ATPs and communicating with providers and being available to be helpful. The two times I've spoken to Mr. Ballard on the phone, he said something so helpful to us early on, which was every time we sell a wheelchair, we had five customers we had to deal with in that one sale. And that's what makes it so hard. I think that was such a mind-opening thought for us. So all of a sudden, you're identifying, going, well, the ATP is a customer of mine. Mm-hmm. And so if they're frustrated with the installer, if I can't make this fast, or if I can't make it easier or successful for them, then I've failed there. So I need to make this successful for them. Same is going to be true with the clinician and the user. And I mean, I have to go right down the line, and the payer is at the end of that too. And I know right now, you know, with the price, it certainly is, you know, it does create questions and no direct way for payment yet. But I do think we will have the data, and we'll have clinical partners doing research for the data to create a really strong case for our Lucy being used in lots of situations.
I'm curious, you mentioned that you used AWS. Why did you choose them?
Jared really had a lot to do with that at the time. We were looking at Google, we were looking at Azure, and it turned out that we had a real opening to some real high-level AWS secure gurus. And so we were like, okay, let's do that. And that did help us in setting up Alexa, but a lot of this was... wandering through the open doors. I mean, I'd love to take credit for all of this and have people think I'm really smart, but the fact of the matter was our team was evaluating sensors, and so as they're working through Intel RealSense sensors, they would find certain things that they might note or make a patch for and send it to Intel, and one day we get a phone call from Intel going, who are you? You're not an automotive company, you're not in military, and your people are sending us really great stuff. And the next thing you know, our little train that could is out at their headquarters working with their team. And so it has been a real blessing. And it sounds nice to say it one way, but the reality is there have been a lot of doors open for us. We've been very fortunate. This is an interesting moment. I think if we had tried to do it 2 years prior, would the sensors have caught up to where we need them to be to do what we're doing? It is a timing thing on this, more so than maybe anything I've ever been around in my own life, where this is just that seam where certain things occurred that probably opened doors for us. And, you know, a lot of people attribute it to divine providence. Some people attribute it to serendipity. Either way, we are very grateful for it and aware of it as a team. You know, like, this door is opened, and so let's treat it with respect, and let's move forward and learn from it. So,
well, speaking of timing, we're right in the middle of a pandemic.
Very tough, yeah.
That's got to be a hard time to start a company.
Horrible time. And yeah, we thought we'd be out sooner. And then we delayed. We wanted to make sure some things were just right. And we wanted to build more relationships with clinics and clinicians, frankly. And we wanted a few more beta users. And so we were trying to move slowly and carefully that way. And then, of course, the pandemic hit. And we made a decision, right or wrong, we made a decision we were going to keep our team together because they've done a phenomenal job. And we would try to weather it as a little startup company. And everybody's been great and pulled together, worked from home. You know, they're in Colorado, a lot of them. So it's very, I mean, here in Tennessee, as you know, we just sort of hunkered down because of Catherine. So, but in Colorado, I think they took it a lot more seriously than it was not the volunteer state. Let's put it that way. And so our team did a really great job and kept pushing through that. Even now, it's not a great time to launch. And so we were kind of looking at the fall, thinking maybe we'll do it then. But there was just a certain moment where we were like, you know, I'm hopeful that new normal will come back and it'll be a lot like old normal, but it may not be. And we had a window and we had some press folks that called and were like, we like the story and we want to run with it. And so we were like, okay, well, you know what? We need to get our name out and meet some people and start talking. So we decided to go for it. But that decision to go on that particular Thursday was made on Wednesday morning. We had a meeting over the weekend where we discussed that it was possible and talked through some of those things. And then on Wednesday at lunch, I called and said, we've done the interviews, they're going to run them, and let's go. And so everybody just turned on the website, turned on, I mean, it was all there behind passwords, but turned on social. And for about 2 weeks there, I just was like, it was a blur. Because we really had shifted to an idea that it'll probably be fall when we do this. But I'm glad we did because of all the people we're meeting. So.
Well, you don't have the pressure of having to fill 150 order a day.
Yes.
Target because I've got overhead and I've got people that I got to pay. So
that's right.
In one sense, it's kind of a good ramp up time.
I think so. You know, one of our mentors, the GPS guy, he always would say, his mentor said, slow is steady and steady is fast. And so we've just tried to be very consistent and sort of steady, and we'll try to grow our team with great people. And I mean, Jared's team out there is bigger. Here we just have a few people, and so as we add people to provide care to clinicians and the foundations and to ATPs, we'll try to bring great people in and make it wonderful. It's been great to be around that team in Colorado.
Barry, thank you so much for coming over and sharing your story and giving me a demo. Please, let's do it again.
Thank you for letting me do this. It's a real honor. I'm kind of, I just do feel so unqualified, but I'm so glad to be here.
Barry Dean, businessman, entrepreneur, songwriter, and co-founder of a cool new company and a cool new product, Lucy. For all of you in podcast land, if you haven't seen Lucy in action, please visit the website for videos and descriptions and stories. Lucy.com, Lucy.com. Make your wheelchair smarter with Lucy. That's all for now. I'm Bill Nolting. Thanks for listening to Talk Rehab.